the Orient, a branch of national policy. Public affairs in this country include a healthy interest in the Orient, as much for its strategic and economic importance as for its traditional exoticism. If the world has become immediately accessible to a Western citizen living in the electronic age, the Orient, too, has drawn nearer to him and is now less a myth, perhaps, than a place crisscrossed by Western, especially American, interests. One aspect of the electronic, postmodern world is that there has been a reinforcement of the stereotypes by which the Orient is viewed. Television, the films, and all the media's resources have forced information into more and more standardized molds. So far as the Orient is concerned, standardization and cultural stereotyping have intensified the hold of the 19th century academic and imaginative demonology of the mysterious Orient. This is nowhere more true than in the ways by which the Near East is grasped. Three things have contributed to making even the simplest perception of the Arabs and Islam into a highly politicized, almost raucous matter. 1. The history of popular anti-Arab and anti-Islamic prejudice in the West, which is immediately reflected in the history of Orientalism. 2. The struggle between the Arabs and Israeli Zionism, and its effects upon American Jews as well as upon both the liberal culture and the population at large. 3. The almost total absence of any cultural position making it possible either to identify with or dispassionately to discuss the Arabs or Islam. Furthermore, it hardly needs saying that because the Middle East is now so identified with great power politics, oil economics, and the simple-minded dichotomy of freedom-loving, democratic Israel and evil, totalitarian and terroristic Arabs, the chances of anything like a clear view of what one talks about in talking about the Near East are depressingly small. My own experiences of these matters are in part what made me write this book. The life of an Arab-Palestinian in the West, particularly in America, is disheartening. There exists here an almost unanimous consensus that politically he does not exist, and when it is allowed that he does, it is either as a nuisance or as an Oriental. The web of racism, cultural stereotypes, political imperialism, dehumanizing ideology holding in the Arab or the Muslim is very strong indeed, and it is this web which every Palestinian has come to feel as his uniquely punishing destiny. It has made matters worse for him to remark that no person academically involved with the Near East, no Orientalist, that is, has ever in the United States culturally and politically identified himself wholeheartedly with the Arabs. Certainly, there have been identifications on some level, but they have never taken an acceptable form, as has liberal American identification with Zionism. And all too frequently, they have been radically flawed by their association either with discredited political and economic interests, oil company and State Department Arabists, for example, or with religion. The nexus of knowledge and power creating the Oriental, and in a sense obliterating him as a human being, is therefore not, for me, an exclusively academic matter. Yet it is an intellectual matter of some very obvious importance. I have been able to put to use my humanistic and political concerns for the analysis and description of a very worldly matter, the rise, development, and consolidation of Orientalism. Too often, literature and culture are presumed to be politically, even historically, innocent. It has regularly seemed otherwise to me. And certainly my study of Orientalism has convinced me, and I hope will convince my literary colleagues, that society and literary culture can only be understood and studied together. In addition, and by an almost inescapable logic, I have found myself writing the history of a strange, secret sharer of Western anti-Semitism. That anti-Semitism, and, as I have discussed it in its Islamic branch, Orientalism resemble each other very closely is a historical, cultural, and political truth that needs only to be mentioned to an Arab-Palestinian for its irony to be perfectly understood. But what I should like also to have contributed here is a better understanding of the way cultural domination has operated. If this stimulates a new kind of dealing with the Orient, indeed, if it eliminates the Orient and Occident altogether, then we shall have advanced a little in the process of what Raymond Williams has called the unlearning of the inherent dominative mode. 1. The scope of Orientalism. Le génie inquiet et ambitieux de l'Européen, impatient d'employer les nouveaux instruments de leur puissance. Jean-Baptiste Joseph Fourier, Préface historique, 1809, Description de l'Égypte. 1. Knowing the Oriental. On June 13, 1910, Arthur James Balfour lectured the House of Commons on the problems with which we have to deal in Egypt. These, he said, belong to a wholly different category than those affecting the Isle of Wight or the West Riding of Yorkshire. He spoke with the authority of a long-time member of Parliament, former private secretary to Lord Salisbury, former chief secretary for Ireland, former secretary for Scotland, former prime minister, veteran of numerous overseas crises, achievements, and changes. During his involvement in imperial affairs, Balfour served a monarch who, in 1876, had been declared Empress of India. He had been especially well-placed in positions of uncommon influence to follow the Afghan and Zulu Wars, the British occupation of Egypt in 1882, the death of General Gordon in the Sudan, the Fashoda incident, the Battle of Omdurman, the Boer War, the Russo-Japanese War. In addition, his remarkable social eminence, the breadth of his learning and wit, he could write on such varied subjects as Bergson, Handel, theism, and golf, his education at Eton and Trinity College, Cambridge, and his apparent command over imperial affairs all gave considerable authority to what he told the Commons in June 1910. But there was still more to Balfour's speech, or at least to his need for giving it so didactically and moralistically. Some members were questioning the necessity for England in Egypt, the subject of Alfred Milner's enthusiastic book of 1892, but here designating a once profitable occupation that had become a source of trouble now that Egyptian nationalism was on the rise and the continuing British presence in Egypt no longer so easy to defend. Balfour, then, to inform and explain. Recalling the challenge of J.M. Robertson, the member of Tyneside, Balfour himself put Robertson's question again. What right have you to take up these airs of superiority with regard to people whom you choose to call Oriental? The choice of Oriental was canonical. It had been employed by Chaucer and Mandeville, by Shakespeare, Dryden, Pope, and Byron. It designated Asia, or the East, geographically, morally, culturally. One could speak in Europe of an Oriental personality, an Oriental atmosphere, an Oriental tale, Oriental despotism, or an Oriental mode of production, and be understood. Marx had used the word, and now Balfour was using it. His choice was understandable and called for no comment whatever. I take up no attitude of superiority, but I ask Robertson and anyone else who has even the most superficial knowledge of history if they will look in the face the facts with which a British statesman has to deal when he is put in a position of supremacy over great races like the inhabitants of Egypt and countries in the East. We know the civilization of Egypt better than we know the civilization of any other country. We know it further back. We know it more intimately. We know more about it. It goes far beyond the petty span of the history of our race, which is lost in the prehistoric period at a time when the Egyptian civilization had already passed its prime. Look at all the Oriental countries. Do not talk about superiority or inferiority. Two great themes dominate his remarks here and in what will follow. Knowledge and power. The Baconian themes. As Balfour justifies the necessity for British occupation of Egypt, supremacy in his mind is associated with our knowledge of Egypt and not principally with military or economic power. Knowledge to Balfour means surveying a civilization from its origins to its prime to its decline, and of course it means being able to do that. Knowledge means rising above immediacy, beyond self, into the foreign and distant. The object of such knowledge is inherently vulnerable to scrutiny. This object is a fact, which, if it develops, changes, or otherwise transforms itself in the way that civilizations frequently do, nevertheless is fundamentally, even ontologically, stable. To have such knowledge of such a thing is to dominate it, to have authority over it. And authority here means for us to deny autonomy to it, the Oriental country, since we know it, and it exists, in a sense, as we know it. British knowledge of Egypt is Egypt for Balfour, and the burdens of knowledge make such questions as inferiority and superiority seem petty ones. Balfour nowhere denies British superiority and Egyptian inferiority. He takes them for granted, as he describes the consequences of knowledge. First of all, look at the facts of the case. Western nations, as soon as they emerge into history, show the beginnings of those capacities for self-government, having merits of their own. You may look through the whole history of the Orientals in what is called, broadly speaking, the East, and you never find traces of self-government. All their great centuries, and they have been very great, have been passed under despotisms, under absolute government. All their great contributions to civilization, and they have been great, have been made under that form of government. Conqueror has succeeded conqueror, one domination has followed another, but never in all the revolutions of fate and fortune have you seen one of those nations of its own motion establish what we, from a Western point of view, call self-government. That is the fact. It is not a question of superiority and inferiority. I suppose a true Eastern sage would say that the working government which we have taken upon ourselves in Egypt and elsewhere is not a work worthy of a philosopher, that it is the dirty work, the inferior work, of carrying on the necessary labor. Since these facts are facts, Balfour must then go on to the next part of his argument. Is it a good thing for these great nations, I admit their greatness, that this absolute government should be exercised by us? I think it is a good thing. I think that experience shows that they have got under it far better government than in the whole history of the world they ever had before, and which not only is a benefit to them, but is undoubtedly a benefit to the whole of the civilized West. We are in Egypt not merely for the sake of the Egyptians, though we are there for their sake. We are there also for the sake of Europe at large. Balfour produces no evidence that Egyptians and the races with whom we deal appreciate or even understand the good that is being done them by colonial occupation. It does not occur to Balfour, however, to let the Egyptian speak for himself, since presumably any Egyptian who would speak out is more likely to be the agitator who wishes to raise difficulties than the good native who overlooks the difficulties of foreign domination. And so, having settled the ethical problems, Balfour turns at last to the practical ones. If it is our business to govern, with or without gratitude, with or without the real and genuine memory of all the loss of which we have relieved the population, Balfour by no means implies, as part of that loss, the loss or at least the indefinite postponement of Egyptian independence, and no vivid imagination of all the benefits which we have given to them, if that is our duty, how is it to be performed? England exports our very best to these countries. These selfless administrators do their work amidst tens of thousands of persons belonging to a different creed, a different race, a different discipline, different conditions of life. What makes their work of governing possible is their sense of being supported at home by a government that endorses what they do. Yet, directly, the native populations have that instinctive feeling that those with whom they have got to deal have not behind them the might, the authority, the sympathy, the full and ungrudging support of the country which sent them there. Those populations lose all that sense of order which is the very basis of their civilization, just as our officers lose all that sense of power and authority which is the very basis of everything they can do for the benefit of those among whom they have been sent. Balfour's logic here is interesting, not least for being completely consistent with the premises of his entire speech. England knows Egypt. Egypt is what England knows. England knows that Egypt cannot have self-government. England confirms that by occupying Egypt. For the Egyptians, Egypt is what England has occupied and now governs. Foreign occupation therefore becomes the very basis of contemporary Egyptian civilization. Egypt requires, indeed insists upon, British occupation. But if the special intimacy between governor and governed in Egypt is disturbed by Parliament's doubts at home, then the authority of what is the dominant race, and as I think ought to remain the dominant race, has been undermined. Not only does English prestige suffer, it is vain for a handful of British officials, endow them how you like, give them all the qualities of character and genius you can imagine. It is impossible for them to carry out the great task which in Egypt, not we only, but the civilized world, have imposed upon them. As a rhetorical performance, Balfour's speech is significant for the way in which he plays the part of and represents a variety of characters. There are, of course, the English, for whom the pronoun we is used with the full weight of a distinguished, powerful man who feels himself to be representative of all that is best in his nation's history. Balfour can also speak for the civilized world, the West, and the relatively small corps of colonial officials in Egypt. If he does not speak directly for the Orientals, it is because they, after all, speak another language. Yet he knows how they feel since he knows their history, their reliance upon such as he, and their expectations. Still, he does speak for them in the sense that what they might have to say, were they to be asked and might they be able to answer, would somewhat uselessly confirm what is already evident, that they are a subject race, dominated by a race that knows them and what is good for them better than they could possibly know themselves. Their great moments were in the past. They are useful in the modern world only because the powerful and up-to-date empires have effectively brought them out of the wretchedness of their decline and turned them into rehabilitated residents of productive colonies. Egypt in particular was an excellent case in point, and Balfour was perfectly aware of how much right he had to speak as a member of his country's parliament on behalf of England, the West, Western civilization, about modern Egypt. For Egypt was not just another colony. It was the vindication of Western imperialism. It was, until its annexation by England, an almost academic example of Oriental backwardness. It was to become the triumph of English knowledge and power. Between 1882, the year in which England occupied Egypt and put an end to the nationalist rebellion of Colonel Arabi, and 1907, England's representative in Egypt, Egypt's master, was Evelyn Baring, also known as Over Baring, Lord Cromer. On July 30, 1907, it was Balfour in the Commons who had supported the project to give Cromer a retirement prize of £50,000 as a reward for what he had done in Egypt. Cromer made Egypt, said Balfour. Everything he has touched he has succeeded in, Lord Cromer's services during the past quarter of a century have raised Egypt from the lowest pitch of social and economic degradation until it now stands among Oriental nations, I believe, absolutely alone in its prosperity, financial and moral. How Egypt's moral prosperity was measured, Balfour did not venture to say. British exports to Egypt equaled those to the whole of Africa. That certainly indicated a sort of financial prosperity, for Egypt and England, somewhat unevenly, together. But what really mattered was the unbroken, all-embracing Western tutelage of an Oriental country, from the scholars, missionaries, businessmen, soldiers, and teachers who prepared and then implemented the occupation, to the high functionaries like Cromer and Balfour, who saw themselves as providing for, directing, and sometimes even forcing Egypt's rise from Oriental neglect to its present lonely eminence. If British success in Egypt was as exceptional as Balfour said, it was by no means an inexplicable or irrational success. Egyptian affairs had been controlled according to a general theory expressed both by Balfour in his notions about Oriental civilization and by Cromer in his management of everyday business in Egypt. The most important thing about the theory during the first decade of the 20th century was that it worked, and worked staggeringly well. The argument, when reduced to its simplest form, was clear. It was precise. It was easy to grasp. There are Westerners, and there are Orientals. The former dominate, the latter must be dominated, which usually means having their land occupied, their internal affairs rigidly controlled, their blood and treasure put at the disposal of one or another Western power. That Balfour and Cromer, as we shall soon see, could strip humanity down to such ruthless cultural and racial essences was not at all an indication of their particular viciousness. Rather, it was an indication of how streamlined a general doctrine had become by the time they put it to use, how streamlined and effective. Unlike Balfour, whose theses on Orientals pretended to objective universality, Cromer spoke about Orientals specifically as what he had ruled or had to deal with, first in India, then for the 25 years in Egypt, during which he emerged as the paramount consul general in England's empire. Balfour's Orientals are Cromer's subject races, which he made the topic of a long essay published in the Edinburgh Review in January 1908. Once again, knowledge of subject races or Orientals is what makes their management easy and profitable. Knowledge gives power. More power requires more knowledge, and so on, in an increasingly profitable dialectic of information and control. Cromer's notion is that England's empire will not dissolve if such things as militarism and commercial egotism at home and free institutions in the colony, as opposed to British government according to the code of Christian morality, are kept in check. For if, according to Cromer, logic is something the existence of which the Oriental is disposed altogether to ignore, the proper method of ruling is not to impose ultra-scientific measures upon him or to force him bodily to accept logic. It is rather to understand his limitations and endeavor to find in the contentment of the subject race a more worthy, and it may be hoped, a stronger bond of union between the rulers and the ruled. Lurking everywhere behind the pacification of the subject race is imperial might, more effective for its refined understanding and infrequent use than for its soldiers, brutal tax-gatherers, and incontinent force. In a word, the empire must be wise. It must temper its cupidity with selflessness and its impatience with flexible discipline. To be more explicit, what is meant when it is said that the commercial spirit should be under some control is this, that in dealing with Indians or Egyptians or Shilluks or Zulus, the first question is to consider what these people, who are all, nationally speaking, more or less in statu pupillari, themselves think is best in their own interests, although this is a point which deserves serious consideration. But it is essential that each special issue should be decided mainly with reference to what, by the light of Western knowledge and experience tempered by local considerations, we conscientiously think is best for the subject race, without reference to any real or supposed advantage which may accrue to England as a nation, or, as is more frequently the case, to the special interests represented by some one or more influential classes of Englishmen. If the British nation as a whole persistently bears this principle in mind and insists sternly on its application, though we can never create a patriotism akin to that based on affinity of race or community of language, we may perhaps foster some sort of cosmopolitan allegiance, grounded on the respect always accorded to superior talents and unselfish conduct, and on the gratitude derived both from favors conferred and from those to come. There may then, at all events, be some hope that the Egyptian will hesitate before he throws in his lot with any future Arabi. Even the Central African savage may eventually learn to chant a hymn in honor of Astrea Redux, as represented by the British official who denies him gin, but gives him justice. More than this, commerce will gain. How much serious consideration the ruler ought to give proposals from the subject race was illustrated in Cromer's total opposition to Egyptian nationalism. Free native institutions, the absence of foreign occupation, a self-sustaining national sovereignty, these unsurprising demands were consistently rejected by Cromer, who asserted unambiguously that the real future of Egypt lies not in the direction of a narrow nationalism which will only embrace native Egyptians, but rather in that of an enlarged cosmopolitanism. Subject races did not have it in them to know what was good for them. Most of them were Orientals, of whose characteristics Cromer was very knowledgeable, since he had had experience with them both in India and Egypt. One of the convenient things about Orientals for Cromer was that managing them, although circumstances might differ slightly here and there, was almost everywhere nearly the same. This was, of course, because Orientals were almost everywhere nearly the same. Now, at last, we approach the long-developing core of essential knowledge, knowledge both academic and practical, which Cromer and Balfour inherited from a century of modern Western Orientalism. Knowledge about and knowledge of Orientals, their race, character, culture, history, traditions, society, and possibilities. This knowledge was effective. Cromer believed he had put it to use in governing Egypt. Moreover, it was tested and unchanging knowledge, since Orientals, for all practical purposes, were a Platonic essence, which any Orientalist or ruler of Orientals might examine, understand, and expose. Thus, in the 34th chapter of his two-volume work, Modern Egypt, the magisterial record of his experience and achievement, Cromer puts down a sort of personal canon of Orientalist wisdom. Sir Alfred Lyell once said to me, "Accuracy is abhorrent to the Oriental mind. Every Anglo-Indian should always remember that maxim." Want of accuracy, which easily degenerates into untruthfulness, is in fact the main characteristic of the Oriental mind. The European is a close reasoner. His statements of fact are devoid of any ambiguity. He is a natural logician, albeit he may not have studied logic. He is by nature skeptical and requires proof before he can accept the truth of any proposition. His trained intelligence works like a piece of mechanism. The mind of the Oriental, on the other hand, like his picturesque streets, is eminently wanting in symmetry. His reasoning is of the most slipshod description. Although the ancient Arabs acquired in a somewhat higher degree the science of dialectics, their descendants are singularly deficient in the logical faculty. They are often incapable of drawing the most obvious conclusions from any simple premises of which they may admit the truth. Endeavor to elicit a plain statement of facts from any ordinary Egyptian. His explanation will generally be lengthy and wanting in lucidity. He will probably contradict himself half a dozen times before he has finished his story. He will often break down under the mildest process of cross-examination. Orientals or Arabs are thereafter shown to be gullible, devoid of energy and initiative, much given to fulsome flattery, intrigue, cunning, and unkindness to animals. Orientals cannot walk on either a road or a pavement. Their disordered minds fail to understand what the clever European grasps immediately, that roads and pavements are made for walking. Orientals are inveterate liars. They are lethargic and suspicious, and in everything oppose the clarity, directness, and nobility of the Anglo-Saxon race. Cromer makes no effort to conceal that Orientals for him were always and only the human material he governed in British colonies. As I am only a diplomatist and an administrator whose proper study is also man, but from the point of view of governing him, Cromer says, I content myself with noting the fact that somehow or other the Oriental generally acts, speaks, and thinks in a manner exactly opposite to the European. Cromer's descriptions are, of course, based partly on direct observation. Yet, here and there, he refers to orthodox Orientalist authorities, in particular Ernest Renan and Constantin de Volny, to support his views. To these authorities, he also defers when it comes to explaining why Orientals are the way they are. He has no doubt that any knowledge of the Oriental will confirm his views, which, to judge from his description of the Egyptian breaking under cross-examination, find the Oriental to be guilty. The crime was that the Oriental was an Oriental, and it is an accurate sign of how commonly acceptable such a tautology was that it could be written without even an appeal to European logic or symmetry of mind. Thus, any deviation from what were considered the norms of Oriental behavior was believed to be unnatural. Cromer's last annual report from Egypt consequently proclaimed Egyptian nationalism to be an entirely novel idea and a plant of exotic rather than of indigenous growth. We would be wrong, I think, to underestimate the reservoir of accredited knowledge, the codes of Orientalist orthodoxy, to which Cromer and Balfour refer everywhere in their writing and in their public policy. To say simply that Orientalism was a rationalization of colonial rule is to ignore the extent to which colonial rule was justified in advance by Orientalism rather than after the fact. Men have always divided the world up into regions having either real or imagined distinction from each other. The absolute demarcation between East and West, which Balfour and Cromer accept with such complacency, had been years, even centuries, in the making. There were, of course, innumerable voyages of discovery. There were contacts through trade and war. But more than this, since the middle of the 18th century, there had been two principal elements in the relation between East and West. One was a growing systematic knowledge in Europe about the Orient, knowledge reinforced by the colonial encounter, as well as by the widespread interest in the alien and unusual, exploited by the developing sciences of ethnology, comparative anatomy, philology, and history. Furthermore, to this systematic knowledge was added a sizable body of literature produced by novelists, poets, translators, and gifted travelers. The other feature of Oriental-European relations was that Europe was always in a position of strength, not to say domination. There is no way of putting this euphemistically. True, the relationship of strong to weak could be disguised or mitigated, as when Balfour acknowledged the greatness of Oriental civilizations. But the essential relationship, on political, cultural, and even religious grounds, was seen in the West, which is what concerns us here, to be one between a strong and a weak partner. many terms were used to express the relation. Balfour and Cromer typically used several. The Oriental is irrational, depraved, fallen, childlike, different. Thus, the European is rational, virtuous, mature, normal. But the way of enlivening the relationship was everywhere to stress the fact that the Oriental lived in a different but thoroughly organized world of his own, a world with its own national, cultural, and epistemological boundaries and principles of internal coherence. Yet what gave the Oriental's world its intelligibility and identity was not the result of his own efforts, but rather the whole complex series of knowledgeable manipulations by which the Orient was identified by the West. Thus, the two features of cultural relationship I have been discussing come together. Knowledge of the Orient, because generated out of strength, in a sense creates the Orient, the Oriental, and his world. In Cromer's and Balfour's language, the Oriental is depicted as something one judges, as in a court of law, something one studies and depicts, as in a curriculum, something one disciplines, as in a school or prison, something one illustrates, as in a zoological manual. The point is that in each of these cases, the Oriental is contained and represented by dominating frameworks. Where do these come from? Cultural strength is not something we can discuss very easily, and one of the purposes of the present work is to illustrate, analyze, and reflect upon Orientalism as an exercise of cultural strength. In other words, it is better not to risk generalizations about so vague and yet so important a notion as cultural strength until a good deal of material has been analyzed first. But, at the outset, one can say that so far as the West was concerned during the 19th and 20th centuries, an assumption had been made that the Orient and everything in it was, if not patently inferior to, then in need of corrective study by the West. The Orient was viewed as if framed by the classroom, the criminal court, the prison, the illustrated manual. Orientalism, then, is knowledge of the Orient that places things Oriental in class, court, prison, or manual for scrutiny, study, judgment, discipline, or governing. During the early years of the 20th century, men like Balfour and Cromer could say what they said in the way they did because a still earlier tradition of Orientalism than the 19th century one provided them with a vocabulary, imagery, rhetoric, and figures with which to say it. Yet Orientalism reinforced, and was reinforced by, the certain knowledge that Europe or the West literally commanded the vastly greater part of the Earth's surface. The period of immense advance in the institutions and content of Orientalism coincides exactly with the period of unparalleled European expansion. From 1815 to 1914, European direct colonial dominion expanded from about 35% of the Earth's surface to about 85% of it. Every continent was affected, none more so than Africa and Asia. The two greatest empires were the British and the French, allies and partners in some things, in others they were hostile rivals. In the Orient, from the eastern shores of the Mediterranean to Indochina and Malaya, their colonial possessions and imperial spheres of influence were adjacent, frequently overlapped, often were fought over. But it was in the Near Orient, the lands of the Arab Near East, where Islam was supposed to define cultural and racial characteristics, that the British and the French encountered each other, and the Orient with the greatest intensity, familiarity, and complexity. For much of the 19th century, as Lord Salisbury put it in 1881, their common view of the Orient was intricately problematic. When you have got a faithful ally who is bent on meddling in a country in which you are deeply interested, you have three courses open to you. You may renounce, or monopolize, or share. Renouncing would have been to place the French across our road to India. Monopolizing would have been very near the risk of war. so we resolved to share. And share they did, in ways that we shall investigate presently. What they shared, however, was not only land or profit or rule, it was the kind of intellectual power I have been calling Orientalism. In a sense, Orientalism was a library or archive of information, commonly, and in some of its aspects, unanimously held. What bound the archive together was a family of ideas and a unifying set of values proven in various ways to be effective. These ideas explained the behavior of Orientals. They supplied Orientals with a mentality, a genealogy, an atmosphere. Most important, they allowed Europeans to deal with and even to see Orientals as a phenomenon possessing regular characteristics. But, like any set of durable ideas, Orientalist notions influenced the people who were called Orientals as well as those called Occidental, European, or Western. In short, Orientalism is better grasped as a set of constraints upon and limitations of thought than it is simply as a positive doctrine. If the essence of Orientalism is the ineradicable distinction between Western superiority and Oriental inferiority, then we must be prepared to note how in its development and subsequent history, Orientalism deepened and even hardened the distinction. When it became common practice during the 19th century for Britain to retire its administrators from India and elsewhere once they had reached the age of 55, then a further refinement in Orientalism had been achieved. No Oriental was ever allowed to see a Westerner as he aged and degenerated, just as no Westerner needed ever to see himself, mirrored in the eyes of the subject race, as anything but a vigorous, rational, ever-alert young Raj. Orientalist ideas took a number of different forms during the 19th and 20th centuries. First of all, in Europe there was a vast literature about the Orient inherited from the European past. What is distinctive about the late 18th and early 19th centuries, which is where this study assumes modern Orientalism to have begun, is that an Oriental Renaissance took place, as Edgar Quinet phrased it. Suddenly, it seemed to a wide variety of thinkers, politicians, and artists that a new awareness of the Orient, which extended from China to the Mediterranean, had arisen. This awareness was partly the result of newly discovered and translated Oriental texts in languages like Sanskrit, Zend, and Arabic. It was also the result of a newly perceived relationship between the Orient and the West. For my purposes here, the keynote of the relationship was set for the Near East and Europe by the Napoleonic invasion of Egypt in 1798, an invasion which was in many ways the very model of a truly scientific appropriation of one culture by another, apparently stronger one. For with Napoleon's occupation of Egypt, processes were set in motion between East and West that still dominate our contemporary cultural and political perspectives. And the Napoleonic expedition, with its great collective monument of erudition, the Description de l'Égypte, provided a scene or setting for Orientalism, since Egypt and subsequently the other Islamic lands were viewed as the live province, the laboratory, the theater of effective Western knowledge about the Orient. I shall return to the Napoleonic adventure a little later. With such experiences as Napoleon's, the Orient as a body of knowledge in the West was modernized, and this is a second form in which 19th and 20th century Orientalism existed. From the outset of the period I shall be examining, there was everywhere amongst Orientalists the ambition to formulate their discoveries, experiences, and insights suitably in modern terms, to put ideas about the Orient in very close touch with modern realities. Renan's linguistic investigations of Semitic in 1848, for example, were couched in a style that drew heavily for its authority upon contemporary comparative grammar, comparative anatomy, and racial theory. These lent his Orientalism prestige, and, the other side of the coin, made Orientalism vulnerable, as it has been ever since, to modish as well as seriously influential currents of thought in the West. Orientalism has been subjected to imperialism, positivism, utopianism, historicism, Darwinism, racism, Freudianism, Marxism, Spenglerism. But Orientalism, like many of the natural and social sciences, has had paradigms of research, its own learned societies, its own establishment. During the 19th century, the field increased enormously in prestige, as did also the reputation and influence of such institutions as the Société Asiatique, the Royal Asiatic Society, the Deutsche Morgenländische Gesellschaft, and the American Oriental Society. With the growth of these societies went also an increase, all across Europe, in the number of professorships in Oriental studies. Consequently, there was an expansion in the available means for disseminating Orientalism. Orientalist periodicals, beginning with the Fundgraben des Orients, 1809, multiplied the quantity of knowledge as well as the number of specialties. Yet little of this activity and very few of these institutions existed and flourished freely, for in a third form in which it existed, Orientalism imposed limits upon thought about the Orient. Even the most imaginative writers of an age, men like Flaubert, Nerval, or Scott, were constrained in what they could either experience of or say about the Orient. For Orientalism was ultimately a political vision of reality whose structure promoted the difference between the familiar, Europe, the West, us, and the strange, the Orient, the East, them. This vision, in a sense, created and then served the two worlds thus conceived. Orientals lived in their world, we lived in ours. The vision and material reality propped each other up, kept each other going. A certain freedom of intercourse was always the Westerner's privilege, because his was the stronger culture he could penetrate, he could wrestle with, he could give shape and meaning to the great Asiatic mystery, as Disraeli once called it. Yet what has, I think, been previously overlooked is the constricted vocabulary of such a privilege, and the comparative limitations of such a vision. My argument takes it that the Orientalist reality is both anti-human and persistent. Its scope, as much as its institutions and all-pervasive influence, lasts up to the present. But how did and does Orientalism work? How can one describe it altogether as a historical phenomenon, a way of thought, a contemporary problem, and a material reality? Consider Cromer again, an accomplished technician of empire but also a beneficiary of Orientalism. He can furnish us with a rudimentary answer. In The Government of Subject Races, he wrestles with the problem of how Britain, a nation of individuals, is to administer a wide-flung empire according to a number of central principles. He contrasts the local agent, who has both a specialist's knowledge of the native and an Anglo-Saxon individuality, with the central authority at home in London. The former may treat subjects of local interest in a manner calculated to damage or even to jeopardize imperial interests. The central authority is in a position to obviate any danger arising from this cause. Why? Because this authority can ensure the harmonious working of the different parts of the machine, and should endeavor, so far as is possible, to realize the circumstances attendant on the government of the dependency. The language is vague and unattractive, but the point is not hard to grasp. Cromer envisions a seat of power in the West, and radiating out from it towards the East, a great embracing machine, sustaining the central authority yet commanded by it. What the machine's branches feed into it in the East, human material, material wealth, knowledge, what have you, is processed by the machine, then converted into more power. The specialist does the immediate translation of mere Oriental matter into useful substance. The Oriental becomes, for example, a subject race, an example of an Oriental mentality, all for the enhancement of the authority at home. Local interests are Orientalist special interests. The central authority is the general interest of the imperial society as a whole. What Cromer quite accurately sees is the management of knowledge by society, the fact that knowledge, no matter how special, is regulated first by the local concerns of a specialist, later by the general concerns of a social system of authority. The interplay between local and central interests is intricate, but by no means indiscriminate. In Cromer's own case, as an imperial administrator, the proper study is also man, he says. When Pope proclaimed the proper study of mankind to be man, he meant all men, including the poor Indian, whereas Cromer's also reminds us that certain men, such as Orientals, can be singled out as the subject for proper study. The proper study, in this sense, of Orientals is Orientalism, properly separate from other forms of knowledge, but finally useful, because finite, for the material and social reality enclosing all knowledge at any time, supporting knowledge, providing it with uses. An order of sovereignty is set up from east to west, a mock chain of being whose clearest form was given once by Kipling. Mule, horse, elephant, or bullock, he obeys his driver, and the driver his sergeant, and the sergeant his lieutenant, and the lieutenant his captain, and the captain his major, and the major his colonel, and the colonel his brigadier commanding three regiments, and the brigadier his general, who obeys the viceroy, who is the servant of the empress. As deeply forged as is this monstrous chain of command, as strongly managed as is Cromer's harmonious working, Orientalism can also express the strength of the West and the Orient's weakness, as seen by the West. Such strength and such weakness are as intrinsic to Orientalism as they are to any view that divides the world into large general divisions, entities that coexist in a state of tension produced by what is believed to be radical difference. For that is the main intellectual issue raised by Orientalism. Can one divide human reality, as indeed human reality seems to be genuinely divided, into clearly different cultures, histories, traditions, societies, even races, and survive the consequences humanly? By surviving the consequences humanly, I mean to ask whether there is any way of avoiding the hostility expressed by the division, say, of men into us, Westerners, and they, Orientals. For such divisions are generalities, whose use, historically and actually, has been to press the importance of the distinction between some men and some other men, usually towards not especially admirable ends. When one uses categories like Oriental and Western as both the starting and the end points of analysis, research, public policy, as the categories were used by Balfour and Cromer, the result is usually to polarize the distinction. The Oriental becomes more Oriental, the Westerner more Western, and limit the human encounter between different cultures, traditions, and societies. In short, from its earliest modern history to the present, Orientalism as a form of thought for dealing with the foreign has typically shown the altogether regrettable tendency of any knowledge based on such hard and fast distinctions as East and West to channel thought into a West or an East compartment. Because this tendency is right at the center of Orientalist theory, practice, and values found in the West, the sense of Western power over the Orient is taken for granted as having the status of scientific truth. A contemporary illustration or two should clarify this observation perfectly. It is natural for men in power to survey from time to time the world with which they must deal. Balfour did it frequently. Our contemporary Henry Kissinger does it also, rarely with more express frankness than in his essay, domestic structure, and foreign policy. The drama he depicts is a real one, in which the United States must manage its behavior in the world under the pressures of domestic forces on the one hand and of foreign realities on the other. Kissinger's discourse must, for that reason alone, establish a polarity between the United States and the world. In addition, of course, he speaks consciously as an authoritative voice for the major Western power, whose recent history and present reality have placed it before a world that does not easily accept its power and dominance. Kissinger feels that the United States can deal less problematically with the industrial, developed West than it can with the developing world. Again, the contemporary actuality of relations between the United States and the so-called Third World, which includes China, Indochina, the Near East, Africa, and Latin America, is manifestly a thorny set of problems, which even Kissinger cannot hide. Kissinger's method in the essay proceeds according to what linguists call binary opposition. That is, he shows that there are two styles in foreign policy, the prophetic and the political, two types of technique, two periods, and so forth. When, at the end of the historical part of his argument, he is brought face to face with the contemporary world, he divides it accordingly into two halves, the developed and the developing countries. The first half, which is the West, is deeply committed to the notion that the real world is external to the observer, that knowledge consists of recording and classifying data, the more accurately, the better. Kissinger's proof for this is the Newtonian Revolution, which has not taken place in the developing world. Cultures which escaped the early impact of Newtonian thinking have retained the essentially pre-Newtonian view that the real world is almost completely internal to the observer. Consequently, he adds, empirical reality has a much different significance for many of the new countries than for the West, because in a certain sense, they never went through the process of discovering it. Unlike Cromer, Kissinger does not need to quote Sir Alfred Lyell on the Oriental's inability to be accurate. The point he makes is sufficiently unarguable to require no special validation. We had our Newtonian Revolution, they didn't. As thinkers, we are better off than they are. Good. The lines are drawn in much the same way, finally, as Balfour and Cromer drew them. Yet 60 or more years have intervened between Kissinger and the British imperialists. Numerous wars and revolutions have proved conclusively that the pre-Newtonian prophetic style, which Kissinger associates both with inaccurate developing countries and with Europe before the Congress of Vienna, is not entirely without its successes. Again, unlike Balfour and Cromer, Kissinger therefore feels obliged to respect this pre-Newtonian perspective, since it offers great flexibility with respect to the contemporary revolutionary turmoil. Thus, the duty of men in the post-Newtonian real world is to construct an international order before a crisis imposes it as a necessity. In other words, we must still find a way by which the developing world can be contained. Is this not similar to Cromer's vision of a harmoniously working machine designed ultimately to benefit some central authority which opposes the developing world? Kissinger may not have known on what fund of pedigreed knowledge he was drawing when he cut the world up into pre-Newtonian and post-Newtonian conceptions of reality, but his distinction is identical with the orthodox one made by Orientalists, who separate Orientals from Westerners. And like Orientalism's distinction, Kissinger's is not value-free, despite the apparent neutrality of his tone. Thus, such words as prophetic, accuracy, internal, empirical reality, and order are scattered throughout his description, and they characterize either attractive, familiar, desirable virtues, or menacing, peculiar, disorderly defects. Both the traditional Orientalist, as we shall see, and Kissinger conceive of the difference between cultures first as creating a battlefront that separates them, and second, as inviting the West to control, contain, and otherwise govern through superior knowledge and a